the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting today live from Birmingham, Alabama. Big story in the news, of course. The question, has man created life? It's the title of my article published today at albertmohler.com. You can find my article there. It deals with the announcement coming from Craig Venter and his associates that they have synthesized artificial life. It's a big story. It's getting all kinds of headlines. And the headlines, by their diversity, tell you something of how this story is being interpreted. The Financial Times headline, scientists create synthetic life form with a computer and four bottles of chemicals. Long headline tells a story. The Wall Street Journal announced scientists create synthetic organism. The New York Times was considerably more restrained. Synthetic bacterial genome takes over a cell, researchers report. Reading that headline, most people might not even go on to read the story. But the opposite approach was taken by The Economist of London. The headline, cover story, and man-made life, the first artificial organism and its consequences. One of the biggest things that comes immediately to mind with this is whether it's a big story or not. Is this really something of significance? And the bottom line is that scientifically it certainly is a significant technological breakthrough, and something artificial is going here. This is the longest synthesizing of a DNA sequence, no doubt about it. But a lot of the headlines are really saying more than is actually going on. We're not actually talking about a fully developed artificial life, you might say, made from scratch or from the ground up. What Venter and his associates did was to take a bacterial cell and remove all of its internal contents, retaining the mitochondrial skeleton, the exoskeleton, more or less, of the cell, and they replaced it with synthesized DNA. DNA, actually, that was programmed by a computer, complete with a watermark with the website of Venter and Associates on it. And it began to replicate. That's the big news. This artificially sequenced, synthesized DNA as a bacterium began to replicate. And thus, it shows signs of life. But let's be very clear. They used organic material to make it. It's not as if they just made it ex nihilo or even out of non-organic materials. But this is one of those big worldview issues that immediately is getting attention. And we need a bit of scientific definition here. We're going to have some help in the next segment. Stephen Meyer, the Discovery Institute, is going to come on and explain to us why this is a big story and what it means, what it doesn't mean. You have immediately people jumping to the conclusion, this is scientists trying to play God. I'm going to argue they're basically right. And there are some very significant issues that Christians ought to be concerned about and aware of here. I have been flooded with emails and requests to talk about this and deal with it. And that's why I published the article this morning. At albertmohler.com, the article's entitled, Has Man Created Life? The answer is no. But is this a significant scientific step? The answer is yes. Are there significant concerns about it? You bet. We're going to be talking about that in just a few moments. Stephen Myers will help us to figure that out. In the meantime, we need to look at some other issues in the news. I was recently in Baltimore just over the last couple of days, and the Baltimore Sun had a fascinating article entitled The Color of Inequality. It's a very interesting thing. The demographics of a country tell us a great deal about the future of the culture. One of the things we've been looking at in this program, internationally as well as domestically, is how, for instance, falling birth rates in much of Europe and amongst certain sectors of the United States point to a very different future. And now in the United States, we're in a very interesting position. We actually have a growth pattern, even in birth rate. But as people look at that, they may miss the bigger story. And Andrew Yarrow has really written something here. And I'll tell you, it must be of interest to anyone concerned about this culture. But I think it should have a particular interest to those who have a missiological interest. That is a real interest and commitment into reaching people with the gospel, trying to figure out what that challenge is going to look like in years ahead. Here's Yarrow's point. There is a significant generation gap, a generational divide in this country, and it's going to get larger and larger because the young literally are getting younger, at least in terms of the demographics. There is an enormous group of children coming. There is an enormous group of older people coming. As people are living longer, and as the birth rate fell for significant years before us, there's going to be this huge divide between people who are getting older and older and a large group of very young people. But what Andrew Yarrow points out is what many people miss, and that is that this generational divide is also a color divide. it is also going to be an ethnic divide. Because even as those who are getting older and older are predominantly white Americans, those who are coming in this big younger wave are predominantly not. And so what we have here is a coming challenge to this country in that there is going to be a group of very old white people and then a group of very young non-white folks in this country who are coming along. And Andrew Eurer points out that for a country, that could be a significant kind of challenge. Because even as generations are often locked into competition for resources and jobs and, for instance, the attention of government and the entertainment and all the rest in the culture, when you mix that generational divide with the fact that it's also going to be a racial, ethnic, cultural divide, it's going to make life a lot more interesting. Now, the question for David Yarrow is whether governments and businesses are getting ready for this. My question is, are churches getting ready for this? Are people concerned with the gospel really watching what is happening and realizing we're going to have a very different kind of challenge out before us? Speaking of challenges, the people of Europe are facing increasing challenges as nation after nation is legalizing same-sex marriage. A surprise in this one, Portugal has now legalized same-sex marriage. President Silva allowed the bill to go into law, and indeed, he did not veto the bill. He said that he was setting aside his personal convictions in order that the government can actually get on with other issues. Now, folks, I just want you to listen to that and realize what an ethical dodge that is. When someone says, I'm opposed to this, but I'm going to sign it into law or allow it to be law so that the government can get on to other business, it means he's unwilling to fight. And that's exactly what's happening here. And that is why on that issue, certainly with Europe in mind, what we have is something of a domino effect as government after government is losing the conviction to deal with the issue. Speaking of dealing with issues, Moab Zaki, writing in the Wall Street Journal, has got a very, very interesting article on Egypt's persecuted Christians, the Copts. The Coptic Christians are one of the oldest groups of Christians there in North Africa, now in what we would call Egypt. And violence against them in this Muslim-dominated country is rising. Mr. Zaki is writing some very interesting material here. It turns out that at Al-Azhar, the world's preeminent Sunni Islamic institution, may remember that President Barack Obama spoke there, giving a very famous address to the Muslim world just recently. There is some official documentation there, including its textbook for high school students there in the institution, that officially states that killing a Muslim is punishable by death, but if a Muslim kills a non-Muslim, he is not subject to capital punishment, since the superior cannot be punished for killing the inferior. Now, again, that's not just something that's on a reading list. That's on the official curriculum at Al-Azhar University. It also states that the blood money or compensation for manslaughter rates for a woman is half that for a man, but for a Jew or a Christian, it is one-third that of a Muslim. There can be no stewardship, such as superior in work, of a non-Muslim over a Muslim. Very interesting. Now, what many people do not know is that even though Islam dominates Egypt, it is a Muslim-dominated nation, about 12% of Egyptians are active Coptic Christians. And it's just a reminder to us, we need to pray for our brothers and sisters there in Egypt. It's also a reminder to us that worldviews matter. And it is not a reassuring thing when the President of the United States associates his prestige with an institution that teaches such things. Very interesting statistics, by the way, coming from African Christianity. I had the honor several weeks ago of spending some time with Peter Akinola, who is the Anglican Archbishop of Nigeria, the primate, indeed, of Nigeria. He's one of those very brave Christian leaders in Africa who is doing an incredible work for the gospel. You know, last week on this program, we talked about the fact that even as you have the American Episcopal Church and the Canadian Anglican Church and, for that matter, even the Church of England playing with such liberalism, what you have worldwide is an Anglican movement that is resolutely conservative. And as Philip Jenkins has pointed out, the average kind of symbolic Anglican these days is not a middle-aged woman going into a cathedral in England. It's a mother of 12 in Africa. Well, Peter Akinola is now retiring as primate of the church in Nigeria. One of the things I pointed out is that the liberal churches keep saying, we're going to have to require the rest of you to go along with us. That's exactly what Ruth Gledhill said at the Telegraph, the Times, just last week. As I wrote about there in that London newspaper, she said Anglicans are going to have to get over their differences in homosexuality and just join the future. Well, Peter Akinola is one of those who will not go. One of the points I made is that what that logic really requires is that the dying sectors of Anglicanism win and get their agenda over the growing sectors. Growing how? Peter Akinola is now retiring. During his tenure, the number of active Anglicans in Nigeria grew from 10 million to 20 million. It's an additional 10 million. More than, by the way, attend Anglican churches in the Church of England in England. We're going to come back to talk about what it means to see these claims that human beings have created artificial life. We'll be back with Stephen Myers. We'll figure this out together. This is the place for intelligent Christian conversation live today from Birmingham, Alabama. You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The cover story in The Economist this week, available on newsstands, pretty much tells the story of how at least some in the media are interpreting the news out of Craig Venter and associates at his lab. The cover story is, and man-made life, the first artificial organism and its consequences. Very interestingly, also in the newsstands right now, Scientific American is a cover story on 12 events that will change everything, future events. We'll talk about some bad timing. It turns out that even as one of the 12 events indicated by Scientific American that would change the future, one of them is the development of synthetic biology and the breakthrough that was announced, well, just a few days before that hit the newsstands. Craig Venter and his associates announcing that they had synthesized a bacterium that had begun to replicate, and thus they're claiming to have created a form of new life. I wrote about this on my website today at albertmohler.com. The title of the article, Has Man Created Life? I raise a host of issues in there. But we need a scientist to help us to figure this out. No one better than Stephen C. Meyer, who's director of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He holds a doctorate from Cambridge University and is well established as a scientist and an observer of such things. Stephen Meyer, welcome to the Albert Mohler Program.
Great to be with you, Al.
Yeah, tell me, just the bottom line, I just have to ask you, if someone came up to you on the street and said, is this a big deal, how would you answer?
No. it's a technological achievement, but it is not the, change in the heartbeat of biology. And one writer at The Guardian that you quoted in your blog today, which is excellent, by the way, Andrew Brown, described this as the moment of complete victory for materialism. And it's quite the opposite if it's anything at all. It shows what you have. What's actually happened is that Venter was able to replace a piece of naturally occurring DNA, copy it outside of the cell, and then put the copy, the synthesized copy of the DNA molecule, into the cell, and then the cell's pre-existing protein synthesis machinery took over and produced the proteins that DNA typically encodes for. It'd be like popping a copy of a CD into a computer and then finding that the computer could read the copy as well as the original. That certainly doesn't show that the person who had copied the information onto another CD had built the computer. That would not be what you'd conclude from that. And what's going on here is that people have a really impoverished view of what constitutes life. It's a reductionist view that says that this DNA runs the whole show. And DNA is very important. It has all kinds of information. The information is stored in a 4-character digital code. I think that provides very compelling evidence of intelligent design. I've just written a book about that topic. But what's going on here is pre-existing information is being copied synthetically by an intelligent agent and then put into a whole complex functionally integrated system that we call life, and the living system uses that inert chemical storing the information to produce what that information usually encodes for, which is proteins.
You know, Stephen, let me just tell you, one of the things that I thought of when I looked at this, and by the way, that very wording you used there, I took out and put in my article this morning precisely because, if anything, this is hardly a moment of complete victory for materialism. I agree with you that this is another indication, I think, of the fact that the world is divinely designed, and certainly life itself is divinely encoded. But, you know, there's something else here. Let me just tell you, just in something I think our listeners can understand here very easily. A lot of people like to watch these survival shows on cable television. And they try to present this as if this guy is really out in the outback of Australia and he really might die. They fail to point out that there's an entire camera crew following him around. Is the only way we have any knowledge of this. Well, you know, this whole thing about artificial life, well, you know, and a complete victory for materialism, this was done by intelligent human beings. And yet those intelligent human beings who are hardly merely material actually had to use organic material to make this happen. One of the things you left out in your sequencing of how they did this was they actually also had to bring in yeast.
Exactly, exactly. Well, one of the things that I discuss in my book, I make a case for intelligent design based on the information-bearing properties of DNA. It's a striking four-character digital code. Our local hero here in Seattle, Bill Gates, says it's like a software program, only much more complex than any we've ever devised. If you think about that, it's very suggestive. We know that programs come from programmers. We know that information generally comes from an intelligent source. And so I've argued that the discovery of information in DNA, which is necessary but not sufficient to produce every organism on Earth, is a compelling evidence of intelligent design, of a prior designing intelligence. What have these gentlemen just illustrated? If, at the very most, they've illustrated the need for intelligence to produce new information.
Yep.
They were the key actors in this, but they're not even producing information from scratch, novel information. They're essentially plagiarizing what was there. So it's not even intelligent design. It's intelligent plagiarism. And then when you provide that copy of that pre-existing information to the cell, guess what? It can use it, and it can do with it what it normally does, which really shows that DNA is not the whole show. It's critical, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient to life. And the information processing system, the protein synthesis machinery, the cell membrane, and the functional integration of all those different parts and subsystems of living systems is immensely complicated, and we really don't have even a handle on what it would take to produce a cell from scratch.
Okay, now, Dr. Meyer, you are the director of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. I want to zero in on the science and culture angle of this for a moment. Let me ask you straightforwardly, why is there a desire among some in the press to present this as something bigger than it actually is? What's going on there from the cultural perspective?
Well, that's where I think, you know, you and your astute audience will be onto this very quickly. It's a worldview issue. There's a default worldview in our elite culture. It is, as this writer from The Guardian termed it, materialism. The idea that matter and energy are the end-all and be-all, the thing from which everything else comes, and the ultimate explanatory principle in all of our experience. And so what gets written out in that is the idea of mind, of purpose, of the possible existence of God. Materialism assumes that only matter and energy are ultimately important. So if the materialist view is that life can be explained in its present operation by reference to matter and motion entirely, and that its origin can be explained by reference to matter and motion entirely. But there's an obvious fallacy in trying to make this discovery support that philosophy, and that is that you have an intelligent designer at work. His name is Craig Venter. He's a very brilliant guy. But and I like your analogy that you gave a minute ago about the, you know, the camera, you know, you're filming the realistic survival experience out in the outback, but you forget you got cameras and you got food trucks and you got everything else. What scientists forget in the lab with things like this is the role of their own intelligence in directing and achieving the results that they do. And it was one of the themes that I struck in Signature in the Cell was I had several chapters on various attempts to simulate the undirected origin of life from the prebiotic soup, from simple inorganic chemicals. But in each of these syntheses, the scientists invariably forgot the role of themselves and the role of their
Absolutely.
Own intelligent design in moving life or chemicals in a life-friendly direction. And I think you have something very similar going on here. Not so much that Venter is claiming that...
Dr. Meyer, I've got to interrupt you. We're going right into a break
here.
We'll be right back with more on the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about this big news, at least you would think it's big news, given the headlines and the cover stories and so many of the print media outlets. Also, just given so much attention, kind of the self-congratulatory attention that often happens in the scientific community, where you have big claims being made about the achievement of Craig Venter. Dr. Venter, by the way, is one of those involved in the sequencing of the human genome. And, very well recognized for that. Over a process of the last several years, about 20 years, every two or three years, he claims some major scientific discovery. And this one is getting a lot of attention, the synthesizing of the longest and largest DNA sequence that began to replicate inside a cell that it was already existent. My guest today is Stephen C. Myers, director of the Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. Dr. Meyer, I want to ask you a question that I think is kind of in the background to many concerns about this, and that is, well, what is the dark side of this? I mean, other than the worldview implications and other than the bigger picture of what this actually means, there is something here about the ability to manipulate life at the genetic level. And what concerns you about that? What should we be concerned about?
Well, I'm less concerned about some of the kind of Frankenstein scenarios that are already being spun on the web, you know, that humans really have the capacity to create life and therefore to choose what kind of life they're going to create, than I am about the military aspects, the biological warfare types of things. Because I think, whereas we can't create life, we don't. One scientist, a bioengineer at Boston University, James Collins, was very direct about this, saying that, really poo-pooing the importance of Venter's work, saying that we don't know well enough what life is to create it yet. It's immensely complex. He's again just created the genetic instruction. He's copied genetic instructions. He hasn't come to anything like creating the information processing system that are necessary to read and express those instructions, and that's a long way to go. But I think that there is probably a legitimate concerns about the ability of people to insert genetic assembly instructions into bacteria and to cause them to produce maybe toxic proteins that could be secreted that might cause new strains of bacterial pathogens, and that I think is probably something that we do need to keep an eye on.
Well, evidently, it's gotten the attention of the White House. President Obama indicated that he's formed a task force to report back within 6 months as to whether there is a national security threat from all of this. And it is well known that there are laboratories that have been dedicated to trying to come up with synthesized pathogens. And you know, just to be honest, that would be a pathogen, a biological agent, for which there presumably would be absolutely no antidote. And that's the scariest aspect of this, is it not?
Yeah, I suppose. I think, you know, a lot of that kind of, dark side of scientific work is probably already going on in rogue states. And the ability, there's in some sense, there's a lot less here than meets the eye. The ability to copy DNA and get it to do something useful was already accomplished in 2002. A scientist named Wimmer was able to make copies of the polio virus and then get them to those synthetic copies to copy themselves in a context. So, I'm not sure that this is even a breakthrough technology from that standpoint, but it does illustrate our ability to manipulate living systems and to probably get some new outcomes that could be pretty nasty. So I do think it's, the Defense Department's monitoring of biological warfare is a good thing to keep on top of.
Let me just ask you again kind of what I asked at the beginning, Dr. Meyer. If someone comes up to you and asks if this is a big deal, you said not so much. Do you think we'll be talking about this, say, a year, 2, 10 years from now?
I kind of doubt it. there's two reasons it's not a big deal. One, it is not producing new life. It's simply copying a piece of information that living systems can utilize. And then secondly, it's not producing new life by a purely undirected, unguided material process. It's producing, to the extent that it succeeds at what it does, it's the result of intelligent intervention. So it's not a great triumph for materialist philosophy. I have a website with a beautiful piece of animation that shows exactly how...
You know, Dr. Meyer, I'm sorry. Once again, we're right up against the break. Okay. We'll be right back with more on the Albert Miller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. It was good to have Stephen Meyer on just to talk about this and kind of get at what it all means. And, what it all means is that this is a big story, but not as big as the media has kind of hyped it up to be. By the way, you can find out a good deal more about Stephen Meyer's work by going to the website, which is signatureinthecell.com. And that's also the title of his new book. And you can also want to go to the website for the Discovery Institute to find out more about its good work. You know, folks, what we're talking about here is a clash of worldviews. That's the most important thing to keep in mind here. When you look at these headlines, what you're seeing is the kind of triumphalistic announcement by materialistic, naturalistic scientists that they've made one more breakthrough to show that we're nothing more than material stuff. That's it. We're just animated material stuff. And materialism is a worldview. And Stephen Meyer talked about this, but let's be very clear about what it is. Materialism is a worldview that says that everything that is and everything that happens and everything we know and everything we experience has to be explained by purely materialistic explanations, which means nothing spiritual. It means nothing outside of material stuff. Literally, it means, well, if you're looking at psychology, it's nothing more than acids and chemicals in the brain. That's all there is to it. We're not actually ensouled beings. For which intelligence is a part of that capacity. It's just chemical reactions with material stuff in the brain. That's all there is to it. It means that your emotions are actually nothing more than the demonstration of the workings of material stuff. It just so happens that a mother loves her child. Just try to come up with a purely materialistic explanation for that. You'll see the poverty of that worldview. But the biggest problem, if you're committed to materialism or to naturalism, which says that everything has to have a purely natural cause, the biggest problem you have is the existence of stuff. Let's face it. Every worldview has to explain why there is something rather than nothing, going all the way back to the ancient Greeks. And it's very difficult to say that the stuff produced stuff. That's the hardest thing to come up with, that literally stuff just happens. And all the stuff we know just happened. And everything that now exists was produced by just other stuff that merely existed. That just doesn't wash. It doesn't meet the kind of worldview demands that any sane or thoughtful person needs. And especially at the most developed part of that, which is the living stuff. It's not just stuff. Explaining rocks is easier than explaining a squirrel. And frankly, explaining a squirrel is far easier than explaining a human being. But what you're talking about here is not a human being, and it's not even a squirrel. You're talking here about a bacterium. You're talking about a very basic kind of being, if you're going to call it a being. An organism is a far better way to put it, because there's no consciousness to it. So you have an organism, and you have the claim here, and again, just looking at the headline of The Economist, that man has made life. No, it hasn't. Human beings have not made life. Human beings have manipulated DNA, a very different thing. And even in manipulating that DNA, Craig Venter and his associates had to use a pre-existing bacterium and just kind of scrape out its DNA, for a better way of putting it, and put synthesized DNA in, and guess what? It began to replicate. Is that a significant breakthrough? It is. And now the commercial aspect of this is huge. In other words, why did they spend $40 million doing this? That's the estimate of the cost of this experiment, $40 million. People don't spend $40 million just to say, okay, I have a successful experiment, I get written up in a scientific journal. They're doing it because there are commercial applications. In particular, Craig Venter hopes that this could produce new carbon fuels. You could create biologically developed fuels to replace oil And let me just say that if that does happen, just think of the commercial application. So that $40 million would turn instantly into untold billions of dollars. That makes sense. But there's a dark side to this, because if actually you can use that kind of technology to develop, say, a self-replicating fuel, you can also come up with a self-replicating virus. You can also come up with something that could have devastating impact on the ecology, devastating impact on humanity. And that's why it's just a reminder to us that science, when it reaches one of these breakthrough moments, is always at the threshold where we have to ask the question, should we go there? And it is fascinating, isn't it? That we're living in a time, we're living in a society that assumes that if something is possible, it must happen. We have lost all ability as a civilization to say there's certain things that just shouldn't happen. And you say, well, human cloning, no one's doing that. Well, why are they not doing that? The honest scientific explanation is because it is not yet possible. But even Scientific American, in this 12 events, it says here that will change everything. Human cloning is one of the things they mention. A lot of the things we're not doing right now are indeed not being done, not because we've merely decided they should not be done in any sane and rational and worldview-based kind of decision-making, but rather, technologically, they just cannot yet be done. And the danger is that there will be a rogue state or a rogue laboratory or a rogue scientist who will simply do this, and once it's done, it's done. It's almost classically like Pandora's box. Once the knowledge is known, you can't unknow it. Once the technology is feasible, you cannot indeed undo it, which is, frankly, a part of the illogic of those who are trying to press for a nuclear-free world. Well, that's impossible. That knowledge is now known, and it is impossible that every single human being on this planet is going to agree to act like we do not know it. In a Genesis 3 world, that is absolutely impossible, and it's true for other technologies as well. So what do we think about all this? Well, number one, let's just take home the quick lesson that there is a lot of hype in this world, and when it comes to reading of something like this scientific achievement, well, one of the reasons why in my article today I gave such a range of headlines is because it demonstrates how some people are ready to overclaim what's going on here. Which also, little footnote, I don't often thank the New York Times, but let me thank the New York Times and Nicholas Wade and the copy editor for coming up with what I consider to be a very restrained and responsible headline, informed by the fact that the body of the article actually says this is not that big a deal. Contrast that with the Economist of London and the cover story saying, and man-made life, the first artificial organism and its consequences. So when you see something like that, just remember this. One of the reasons why on this program, time and time again, I suggest you need multiple sourcing in order to understand current events. You can't just look at one newspaper, one magazine, and say, I've got it. You really need multiple sourcing, because on something like this, if you just looked for 10 minutes of different headlines, they would tell you there's a difference of opinion about what this means. The second thing is, once again, worldviews matter. And in this case, what you have being pushed here is a materialistic, naturalistic, secular worldview that is trying now to claim this little experiment in a petri dish proves that there was no God. Well, nice try. But the petri dish did not make itself. And this organism did not synthesize itself. And that's just another reminder, unless we need the reminding, we did not make ourselves. Back with final thoughts in just a moment, live from Birmingham, Alabama. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. You can find my article, Has Man Made Life, at albertmueller.com. You can also follow from my article the links to the other articles that form the background for this. And I would encourage you to do this. This is one of those very interesting lessons about the intersection of science and life, about worldview and life. And this is a good one to think through. If you know a college student or high school student, I almost guarantee you they're going to be presented with this kind of headline. And routinely in school, they're going to be told this is a huge deal. And as you see, we don't need a creator. Look at what just happened in the laboratory. And that's where we need to come back and say, wait a minute, who was in that laboratory? A created human being, that's who. and this did not happen just by itself. There's some obvious problems here. You know, on the program I mentioned earlier, I enjoy, frankly, watching some of these things, these adventure programs, these survival programs. You drop somebody in the middle of the desert. I'm always fascinated to see these people who eat tarantulas and swim with crocodiles just in order to get where they need to go to survive. It's fascinating stuff. But it's not real. Not when you consider there's a huge film crew following this person through all of this. And that's pretty much the way it is here. We often forget that the scientist who is conducting the scientific experiments is indeed created in the image of God, has intelligence that is given to him by his creator, and didn't just happen. And it's just another reminder that sometimes we just need to take a step back and say, no, wait just a minute. This is not a laboratory thing. This is just another reminder of the fact that the human being had to go in the laboratory for this to happen. I am in Birmingham, Alabama. Glad to be broadcasting today live from Hunter Street Baptist Church. It's good to be back in Birmingham. I went to college here. I'm somewhat humbled to say, 30 years ago I graduated from Samford University here in Birmingham, Alabama. And a lot of change has taken place in 30 years. I just have to come back to the city once in a while to get the scale of that change. Having my hand a new magazine. It's entitled Be Metro, the magazine of Metro Birmingham Living. The cover story, New Religion, Faith Has a New Face in Birmingham. It's young and hip and media savvy. It's not your grandmother's church anymore. Well, it's just another reminder that change is always around us. And even as we as Christians are called to be truth tellers, and we have the responsibility to reach our culture and to speak to those around us, to bear the good news of the gospel and to think as Christians in the midst of our own times, we need to recognize the times are changing. And when I say that, let me just ask you to contemplate. 10 years ago, we could not have had the conversation we had today. As a matter of fact, 10 days ago, we could not have had the exact conversation we had today. If you go back just a couple of generations, there will be absolutely no connect with what we're talking about today. And if we have enough time, it won't be long before generations to come will have little clue about why we thought these things are so important today. Our responsibility, though, is not to live in the past, nor to wait for the future, but to live in the present, thinking, believing, acting like Christians. We'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. We'll talk about what's on your mind. I'll meet you tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. Thanks for listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.